Konnichiwa.
Hello.
I'm Keiko and I'm
Mike. I'm Mike Kubumatsu.
Inorganic filters are being zinc oxide.
But when you get a disease,
what they love in Russia.
Bubble Radio.
Hello and thank you for tuning back into Bubble Radio. Today I am joined by powerlifting athlete from Singapore and also a coach at The Strength Guys. We have Jonathan Chua today. Thank you for making the time to be on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm Jonathan Chua. So as Hanan has mentioned, so I'm very happy to be on this podcast joining her. And hopefully I can bring my value and experience to the audience that will be listening on.
Great. And I know that you just had your wedding this month, right?
Yes, it was last Saturday, actually.
Last Saturday. Congratulations. Yeah. And thank you for making the time again.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, so I was lucky enough to interview the president of The Strength Guys, Jason Tremblay, on the show a month or two ago, and I know The Strength Guys have a lot of like coaches around the world, like yourself in Singapore, and I'm very curious to know what is your journey been like with The Strength Guys, like how did you start coaching there and stuff like that?
Okay, so as a pretty interesting story, just like how powerlifting was pretty new when I first started back in 2014. I think that was the second meet hosted ever in Singapore.
Wow.
So that's when I first started or found powerlifting. And I just really love the sport of the constant progression that you can make with the body, chasing these small little goals. It really relates to life. Mm-hmm. That you can't take big steps or at the shot, mainly just over time with experience, you get better.
Mm-hmm.
And then I happened to have the opportunity to meet Ryan Doris back in 2015 when he came down to Singapore.
Okay.
So he was part of De Novo Nutrition, not formally. Now they are called Elemental Formulation.
Okay.
Yeah. So from there on, I managed to expand my connection with a lot of the overseas coaches or company. That's where I met Jason in 2015 as well. So there on, he came to Singapore. So he did ask me around and I managed to show him around in Singapore as well. So that's how we first met. Yeah. And that's also the time where I dive myself into powerlifting coaching because of my background in sports science. So I really enjoy the research on how to improve performance altogether, not just in powerlifting and sporting performance as well. So it always been on and off conversation with Jason, but him being Canadian, I think it's just him being very nice. So I reached out to him.
Yeah.
Back in 2018 for internship opportunity so that I can improve my knowledge and provide better value to my clients. And that's where I first hopped on to The Strength Guys. So yeah, the internship was with Jason and Ben Escrow back at that time. So it was a lot of late night calls because of the time difference. So the calls was like 1, 2 a.m. over on my end. Yeah, but it was pretty insightful for what they share. And they really brought out the knowledge of powerlifting. So I learned a lot from there and actually experienced it with my clients. And they definitely shows very promising results. So I only managed to join them full time in 2019. That's where Jason had the opening for a coaching slot, and I took that opportunity immediately. How could I say no to him?
2019. So that's been like 4 years since you started your internship.
Yeah, so 4 years since my internship, and 2019 I hopped on being a full time coach with them.
Wow, it's amazing how like connections like that can open a lot of doors for you, because you probably in 2014 when you did your first meet, you probably didn't think that you'll be doing a full-time powerlifting coaching, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Just connections like that it's great, especially through like Instagram and social media, I guess. You can connect with people that you never thought you could connect, which is really exciting too, right?
Yeah, definitely. This is how I got to meet you as well. I think it's very exciting for me. Being the first time on a podcast.
Mm-hmm. And also, in 2014, you mentioned it was the second meet ever to be hosted in Singapore. And you hopped onto an internship in 2015. And I would probably assume that online coaching was probably not a thing back then, right, in Singapore?
Not at all. So the internship I hopped on 2018, sorry on that.
Okay, so, 2018.
Yeah, 2018, yeah. And online coaching wasn't a thing back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was more so of, I'm not too sure how Japanese would call it, but I think the term is personal training.
Personal training.
Yeah, so a lot of powerlifters goes to powerlifting gym to get training with a coach face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no online powerlifting coaching till like maybe 2017. That's where a lot of coaching company in Singapore starts to pop up and it become more of a mainstream thing. Now there's very little face-to-face powerlifting coaching, more so of online.
Right. So were you worry because no one else is doing trying to be a powerlifting online coach when you started, right? Maybe in the United States that was a big thing, but even in Japan right now it's just starting up, the online coaching business. Did you see the potential in online coaching in Singapore? Where was your mind at when you started the internship?
I think there's potential with it. More so because although Singapore is very small, we can travel end to end in 40 minutes, but just having that ease of communication through social media or online, it saves the time for traveling down to gym to actually help them face to face. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of value with video analysis as well, where they send in their video and we can make the rightful adjustment or advice that we can give them to help them improve on their lift. So I think that was something that was pretty limited in face-to-face training. So that was the potential that I see. Definitely right off the start, I was very new to it. And a lot of processes was not the best, but I think over time with reviewing and learning, and then the internship opportunity, it actually gave me the knowledge and experience on how to provide a better value for my clients altogether.
And I know that there are a lot of benefits to face-to-face training as well, but there may be more benefits in another area to online coaching that out-benefits what face-to-face training, like you mentioned, videos, right? Like if you do face-to-face training, you see their lift once and that's it. But if you do online coaching, you can replay the video, you can be really, you can look for specific parts of the movement and break it down, analyze it, and things like that. That's another benefit that you cannot really get from face-to-face training. What are some other benefits of online coaching that you cannot experience with face-to-face training? Do you have any more in mind?
More benefits.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
It's okay. I think online coaching, similar to connections, it actually brings in a lot more variety of clients that you would not expect. Because face-to-face, people will come in and know that you are expertise in this area. But online, sometimes when they reach out to you, you can actually get a myriad of clients or at a general population that is starting the sports. And I think that is very interesting and value-adding to me because working with different types of athletes from general population getting into the sports to elites that is competing at the world level, the way they improve and learn is totally different. Mm. And that actually value add. So I would consider that as a benefit and also the opportunity to meet more people and over time getting to know them on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the benefits as well, because some of them are expertise at different areas. Some may be like designing, some in finance. Mm-hmm. So the other people, I actually reach out back to them if I need those advice. So that's pretty good for me as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. The connections that you make as well, a lot of benefits too. So are your clients like in Singapore, or are a lot of them, I know you have international clients as well, but out of the clients that you coach, how much of them are in Singapore and how much is in like international?
Okay, I think if I recall correctly, currently the split is 50-50. I have 14 Singapore clients and 14 international clients.
Wow, that's a lot. And I guess that's a good thing with online coaching too, because you can, if you try to coach 28 athletes face-to-face, like a full time, that's like a lot of time, right?
Yes,
yeah, with
definitely.
Online coaching, it makes it possible. So that's another, that's another benefit too. No, that's really interesting. You are also a competitor too, right? You're an athlete as well.
Yeah.
As well, and you are also a coach, so you've experienced both sides. On personally, do you think you're more suited as a coach or as an athlete?
Well, that's a tough question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say I'll put myself more so as a coach because I prioritize my clients or athletes more than myself.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's competition in Singapore and there's a lot of them competing, I wouldn't put myself in a spot to compete.
Mm.
So I can give all my attention to them because them setting out to reach their goals and actually achieve their personal goal or even better, the national title, I think it's much more enriching for me as a coach, as opposed to me winning just one title altogether. Mm. Although I still want to do it, but I think the time and attention spent, I will prioritize it to my clients.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
It's more fulfilling to provide and try to get more titles and to, you know, make a lot of different people's dreams come true instead of you winning, which is also satisfying, but not as satisfying as like you growing and helping clients and them succeeding and seeing that. Yeah, okay. That's okay. What are some other moments where you are like, okay, I'm really glad that I am coaching, like I am doing coaching. Do you have any other moments like that?
I would say moments that I'm glad is actually them learning from the coaching over time. Because I always tell my clients that what I truly value is that I can provide the education necessary for them to learn about powerlifting or just programming in general, so that in the long run, they are well educated to program for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't stick to coaching for like a lifetime contract.
Mm-hmm.
More so it's just like for a duration that they need and they learn from that. And I think that is a really proud moment when they tell me that, coach, I really do everything on my own. I learned a lot from you and that you provide all the education necessary for me to make my journey possible without any additional supervision, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes more so they build up the autonomy over time, which is my proudest moment, to be very frank. Yeah.
So it's more like educating your clients to maybe continue the sport long term, and just the whole whole teaching side is also very satisfying for you.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
For them to learn to pick up sport science, I think it's very interesting for them as well. Some of them would discuss with me on the hot topics. Like, is it really necessary to train to failure, or should we stay far from failure? I think all those are very interesting topics that they can take away through multiple discussion.
Right, okay. So, like, obviously, for people that are, like, trained by themselves without a coach, to getting coaching from you, what are some of the changes that they have had? Well, I've just recently been teaching this one girl who was training by herself and always maxing out and things like that. And I just taught her basic, you know, like, oh, you should probably, you know, do like progressions like this. Or you should maybe like think about volume and all the things like that. And she told me, like, I have so much direction with my training now. Like, before, I didn't know where I was headed. Like, I was just doing, you know, what I thought was right at the time, and, you know, maxing out and things like that. But with like coaching and stuff like that, you have more of like, okay, I want to reach this certain goal. Like, there's a direction of where they are headed. That's what she said. Are there any like your clients' words from your clients that they thought was a big change since they started coaching? Is that a weird question?
A big change, I think the most prominent one is that they realize they actually do not need that much volume to actually improve. Because a lot of time prior to coaching, because I think there was a period, I can't remember which year, I think there was this statement mentioned by people online. I can't remember who said it, but it was volume is king.
Okay.
So... yeah, when doing volume, it improved very drastically. And then they took on this word fully, and they just go hard. They never, they do progress, but it definitely reaches ceiling very early. So they get a huge amount of PR in a short time. But usually they end up with a lot of pain, soreness, or injuries even. So I think one common program that they did before coaching with me was like the Russian squat program. I think it's called Smolov.
Smolov?
Yeah, Smolov. Yeah, so that one is pretty intense. I don't remember any one of them making it out without any injuries.
Yeah, neither. It's easy to, I think it's easier for a lot of beginners because they don't really have to think about the difficult stuff, you know, like manipulating like intensity, volume, and, you know, fatigue and things like that. They don't really have to think about it. You just need to, I'm just going to do as much as I can, you know, what's being put on me in front of me, and then just try to, maximize their strength. But with coaching, maybe it teaches them to think? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it gives them the idea to think. And like you mentioned, giving them the direction of where they are headed during each phases. So the goals are met at every cycle. So I think it's more fulfilling taking like a step at a time. So they understand that for the next period, what are we focusing on? So the direction is really important in terms of why they are training and the purpose of their training.
Yeah, and if you get that, I think it just makes training so much more satisfying too.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm also curious to know what... I've touched on it a little bit on my episode from last year with Dylan, who's... he's actually a powerlifting coach and a gym owner in Singapore. About powerlifting in Singapore. And I know you touched on it a little bit, but what has it been like right now, like powerlifting in Singapore with the whole COVID situation?
Okay, so powerlifting Singapore, with the COVID situation, it has stopped fully for close to 2 years now. there was the national event in April in 2019. But that was postponed due to the evolving situation with COVID. So currently, all the sporting event over here has ceased unless it's regulated by the Sports Advisory Board. So hopefully the situation improves and that's where meet can start to happen. Because I think there was some discussion within the community of hosting virtual meets. But then I think it got knocked away because of how to be very precise with the load use, because some gyms have different types of bars and weights and right. it may not be the most fair way to to give the awards out. So I think that was knocked out of the window. But yeah, right now it's still really quiet. Hopefully if everything proceeds well and the government opens up a little bit more, maybe some modified ways of competing like masks on, I think that would be really great and beneficial to the community because a lot of people has been training hard. A lot of them got home gym during this period.
Nice.
The amount of home gym I see is popping up everywhere. So I think it's a good platform for them to actually compete and really show out their progresses. I think it will be really fulfilling for them.
What about like the motivation of athletes that you have in Singapore? Have there been athletes that have been really unmotivated because they don't know when they're going to compete? They don't know when they are able to compete and there hasn't been any meets on the last 2 years. What are the motivations of a lot of your Singaporean athletes being like?
I think there's two spectrum to them. Those with home gym are extremely motivated because they're still making progression even with the limited accessibility to equipments. So they're making the best of what they have and improving from there. For those on the other end of the spectrum, very unmotivated. It's because of the uncertainty, like you mentioned, not too sure when a competition is coming up. They just really sit back and relax through this whole period. And it's hard to get them moving because most of them, or rather my clients, are working adults. So with the COVID situation, I think most of us actually experience longer working hours. So they actually took that into play and didn't schedule that quote-unquote me time to actually go out and exercise or just train through something that can at the very least maintain their physical properties. But things over here should be opening up on 21st June. So I think that news that was released got them more motivated to get back on track already. So
okay, so, yeah, so it's the what is it like right now? Are gyms not open?
Yeah, all the gyms are closed currently. Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the unmotivation coming from the closure of gyms.
Yeah. I wonder how businesses are doing, because in Japan it's like they try to close down gyms start of or mid 2020, but they realized that they cannot maintain the business, like so they had to open back up. But it's crazy that Singapore is, they're still, they can do that, because in Japan they cannot close down gyms anymore. But it's, I don't know. I don't know how it works in Singapore, but I think it's crazy that that they can do that.
Yeah, the government, because they are giving out relief funds to businesses that are closed down, so I think they're still able to call the shots on closing down businesses during the period.
Okay. So with the, if they close, they get some sort of relief money. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's move on a little bit about the topic of our conversation today. I want to ask a little bit about peaking for competition, since from my perspective, I think the Strength Guys has a lot of athletes who are outstanding, not only in the gym, but also on the platform. They get really, really good results. So I'd love to ask a little bit about that. So when you pick your clients for a competition, what are you aiming to do during this time? Like, what is it that you want to achieve during this peaking period?
During a peaking for my clients, I think what the main goal to achieve is basically how they can express their full potential mm-hmm. on a given day. Mm-hmm. Because most meets run on a single day, not like competitive sports where it runs through like season.
Mm-hmm.
So preparing their body mm-hmm. to show out on that particular day is something that I would like to strive for. And in terms of training, is mainly to build up their confidence mm-hmm. or momentum
mm-hmm.
so that once they get on the platform, they know that they'll be able to complete the load that is given to them, or rather the attempts that are given to them, and aim to strive for a 9-for-9 meet, and that will give them the biggest total of the day.
I love that you mentioned not only the physical potential, but also how like being confident in yourself and building that momentum, like the mental side, the aspect of it. I love that you have mentioned that. Okay, so what is your peaking for your clients look like? When does it start, and what are the some things that you keep in mind?
So for my clients, usually it starts about 1 or 2 4 weeks out, depending on the lifter's training history or the weight class of athletes mm. and or their current total. Mm. So if to put it on a more general side of things, let's say 4 weeks, for example. So that's a phase where we slowly build up on intensity while reducing the overall volume by a modest amount. So that somewhere with a reduction of 20 to 40% of reduction in training volume,
mm-hmm.
while intensity would stay closely around 85 to 95, sometimes mm-hmm. even higher.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, week to week, the training would also remain pretty similar from week 1 to week 4, but the intensity slowly progresses from there, depending on how they are adapting each week.
Mm-hmm.
And then therefrom out, usually 2 weeks out, that's where I do quote unquote a mini assessment, where I give them a fatigue single to assess where would their strength lies when they are fatigued, because that gives me a really good indicator of mm-hmm. how they would perform during competition week. And then the last week, usually we take a stat taper. Mm-hmm. So a further reduction of training volume and a slight decrement of training intensity, usually around 5 to 10% drop in intensity.
Mm-hmm.
So that to dissipate the fatigue that they have built up through the weeks. And then usually we recommend rest of about 1 to 2 days. Mm-hmm. So of complete rest mm-hmm. and that they will be ready to perform on midday.
Mm. So you mentioned a little bit about, I missed it. Meet assessment? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, a mini assessment.
Meaning assessment?
Yeah, like just a small assessment within their training to see where they are currently at with their strength level.
Right. So by doing this, are you able to... So you're obviously able to assess what they are when they... what their strength is like when they're fatigued. Does that help you with attempt selection? Like, how does that help you as a coach?
So, definitely help me with attempt selection, because if they are able to complete it with so much fatigue through the weeks, it gives me a very good indicator that even on their worst day, they'll be able to complete the fatigue single load that they have just did over on this week. So those are usually on the safer side on the attempt selection during competition. And on a good day, there's usually a number that is slightly higher, about 2.5 to 7.5 kilos more than what they did when they were fatigued.
Okay, so when they do it at this assessment, are we talking like second attempt numbers?
Yes, second attempt. Usually it's second attempt. Yeah.
Okay, that's a really, really interesting way, because if they grind out this second attempt during this assessment period, what would you think? Would you think maybe they can not handle as much more? Like, what do you think about when they grind out during this assessment period?
For this, I think usually I go really broad on how to identify what may be the issue if they actually grind out the quote unquote second attempt. More so is if there's any changes to their external stresses outside of gym. Mm-hmm. Are they really stressed out about the meet, or like if their overall work has eating out on them in terms of their sleep and nutrition. And if just on training aside, if they were really grinding out, I would think that they are not adapting to the stimulus. So that when they actually taper, we'll do a bigger reduction of taper. So it's a more aggressive taper so that they can fully dissipate that fatigue.
Okay. So by looking at that, you're also able to adjust and manipulate the rest and how much fatigue that they need to drop and everything like that. Okay.
Yes, correct.
So it's not, if they, for example, if they fail this during the assessment, like, it's still not too late.
You just need to manipulate.
Okay. That kind of could be like mentally challenging for the athletes though, don't you think?
Yeah, it's definitely very mentally challenging. I have athletes that definitely experienced those before. Them failing the second attempt 2 weeks out from the competition. So it definitely hit them really hard. But just building the good taper strategy so that the fully reduce the fatigue, and then a good workout of the competition strategy or meet attempt, they can actually build up on a bigger total as well. So they definitely will have that mental barrier, as you mentioned, or the challenges faced. But I think once they reach the competition venue or just experiencing from the competition hype, I would say, they usually forgo what was done, and they really focus on what is at present, and they tend to show out even better than what they did on the assessment that they have performed.
It's probably really important as a coach to like keep their confidence too. Like if they did not do so well during this period, I mean, like, okay, I've adjusted this taper and managed your fatigue properly, so on meet day, it'll be fine. And then maybe they can go in more confidently, you know, because they've already experienced what it's already going to be like.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to, it's not probably, it's definitely going to be better without the fatigue. So maybe it could lead to more confidence too. Okay. I also think that maybe second attempt, during second attempts 2 weeks out, maybe for a 47 kilo lifter could not be that damaging, but as a 120 kilo lifter, doing your second attempt 2 weeks out could be really fatiguing. Like, don't you think it's an unnecessary fatigue that they're building up, like a damage to their body, like 2 weeks out?
I would definitely agree with that, based on the size of the lifter. So, usually for heavier lifter, they tend to have, I would say, a slower recovery. Usually, the 105, 120 kilos, depending on their training history. So their assessments tends to be much earlier, like 5 weeks out. And then, from 4 weeks out onwards, it's mainly just building confidence. So their volume reduction is much greater as compared to like lifters that are like under 93 kilos. And for female, based on the current research, it tends to show female recover faster. I'm not exactly sure what may be the best way to actually taper because of the data showing that they recover faster. So there's still a big question mark until more research is out, and I don't dare to comment on that because that is really out of my field. Definitely a difference between a 47 kg lifter versus a 120 kg lifter in terms of the way they peak and taper into competition.
Okay. So you obviously adjust with the size and stuff like that. And also that makes me curious about, like, you said at the very start about when you start your peaking, look, from like 4 weeks out and things like that, according to the size and also their lifting experience. Why does lifting experience influence when they start their peak period?
Okay. Lifting experience is mainly the I would say more so on how much they have done before or what was their peak volume that they have done in prior phases. Because if they are really new and their work capacity is really low, so tendency is that they need a shorter peaking period, maybe about 2 weeks or 1 week to actually experience their improvement in training, let's say a beginner. But let's say for an intermediate and to advanced, they may need 3 to 4 weeks because they are able to tolerate more training volume and they need a bigger stimulus to actually improve their performance. So for elites, I have seen people peaking for my clients, in my opinion, is I've done 6 weeks of peak because they just need to do that much to actually maintain their overall performance. So it's really based on how much they have previously done and how much is needed to actually maintain and or improve their overall strength potential.
That means that if they are a beginner, they're likely to have a smaller working capacity during their whole season, meaning that they're okay to have a shorter peak period.
Yep. Yes.
Okay. During this peaking period, is it easier to predict how elites would perform? Or is it easier to predict how a beginner would perform? I don't know, just curious.
I would say elite are easier to predict because they have nailed down their technical proficiency. So their form is very replicable from, let's say, 70% up to like 90%. The main difference may be only the bar velocity change. But for a newer lifter, because they may not be as proficient, so sometimes a slight deviation of their form affect their overall strength.
That's true.
So sometimes it may be like RP9, let's say for their second attempt or RP10, but then when they go to meet it, it becomes like RP6.
Yeah.
So, so those, although they still hit a PR, but it really keeps me curious of what they will be their true potential on meet day.
And that's all about technique.
Yeah, because of their coordination, they can't express their full strength potential.
That always, I mean, it's a good thing if it's going a good way.
Yeah.
It's always a big surprise, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it really threw me off guard in competition because, like, wow, how much can you actually do more?
Yeah. Like a third attempt being super easy. I'm like, oh, shit. Okay. And also with RPEs too, especially with beginners, it's hard to use RPEs for beginners. They don't know how to use it. What do you do when things like that happen? Like when they don't know how to, and you can't, it's hard for you to assess, like, what is it really RPE8 or RPE9? Like, what do you do?
For them, I use a combination for percentages and ask them to rate their last set RPE So from there, I get a sense of how their like RP8 would look like. And then through the season, usually not during picking because I want to get the data earlier, I give them an assessment, MREP, as many repetition as possible.
Right.
So I'll ask them to MREP the load up to a certain rep range. And then from there, they will get a better sense of what RPE 9 may look like or feel like.
Right.
And then from there, they will recalibrate in their head. So over time, they also learn of what's their true RPE 8, RPE 9.
So a person who's never really maxed out doesn't know what maxing out feels like. So maybe it's good to have that. Obviously, not all the time, but just like at least one time where they do an AMRAP. Very, very important. So just to maybe summarize what you've said about the whole peaking process, usually the whole meaning of peaking is to put out their full potential of their strength is the meaning.
Yes.
And what you do is increase the intensity, usually about up to 85 to 95%. While dropping volume from 20 to 30%, and that they do almost the same thing, but gradually increase intensity and gradually drop volume. Would that be right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
What is the rep scheme? What does the rep like numbers look like during this period?
Usually we work on lower repetition range. So under 5 repetition during a picking phase, very rarely we exceed that, but for certain individual or intermediates or beginners, they tend to need a little bit more repetition to maintain their strength. So they may go up to 7 repetition at the very high ceiling. But for most cases, it's under 5 repetition all the way down to 1 repetition. So they get a more precise practice of how they would play, mainly from like SBD days. So they perform a lot of singles in squat, bench press, and deadlift in that order to condition their body for what's to come on midday. So midday will be much easier as compared to training.
Okay. So maybe with like intermediate to elite athletes, you are always doing below 5 reps, but maybe decreasing as you go? Or is it kind of the same every week, the reps?
For beginners, we tend to go a little bit more on linear progression. So just drop in the repetition and just increase in volume, increase in intensity.
Okay. Interesting. What are some of like the mistakes that people, maybe not with you, but in general, when people that are not coached by you, like some of the mistakes that athletes tend to do during this peaking period?
I think the most common thing I see, or rather two common things I saw, is they are not training near their competition weight. They are like more than 3% heavier than their competition weight. And because of that big decrement of body weight that they have to do on midweek, they tend to suffer a little in their performances. So I think a good guideline to say for the very least is to stay within 3% of your competition weight and not more than that, so that any further reduction of that, depending on your competition, because for most IPF meets is 2-hour weigh in. So it's quite challenging to actually refuel the necessary hydration if you did do a water cut. But if it's a 24-hour weigh in, I'm not too sure if Japan's have that.
No.
24-hour window. Yeah. So those, maybe we can get a little bit more greedy with the body weight, because there's more leeway for you to refuel after the weigh in. Yeah, so that is one area I saw. Another one, I think, is mainly towards newer lifters, because they are so driven by the numbers they want to put up on the bar.
Yeah.
They they do not set a realistic expectation of what to expect. So they end up, like you say, grinding up weights, but they do it on a weekly basis. So that adds on a lot to their fatigue, and they don't actually able to reduce the fatigue even if they taper. So they end up having a bigger decrement in training performances during the meet itself.
So picking the wrong weights. Well, just going back to your first point about body weight. So if someone had maybe like 5 kilos to lose for a competition, you would recommend them to start way earlier, to diet way earlier before the whole peaking phase starts.
Yeah, so usually what the best case scenario that I would recommend is that they get their body weight down at the very least 8 weeks out of competition. So to competition weight at the very least 8 weeks out, so that during the 8 weeks out, we can increase their overall calorie intake, because training will be much more challenging as compared to the earlier phases, so that they can recover and adapt to the heavier intensity stimuli, so that they get a better sense of their recovery, and that we can predict better of what they are able to do come midday. So an early start and then maintain throughout the peaking period.
So it's good to not really change anything during this time, especially body weight, because you can, it kind of changes, like, I think it like affects your form too. Like if you have
lower
body weight, and it affects how strong you feel and things like that. So it's good to not change anything during this peaking phase, especially body weight.
Yeah, because sometimes I think some of them actually experience from a big weight cut is that they find that some area of their joints are less meaty, so they can't actually replicate the same form as they did while they are slightly heavier.
Right.
So that's pretty interesting. Yeah.
It is. It's like during the squat, right? Getting depth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And the second point is like beginners tend to have a big ego when it comes to picking weights. Is that what you mean, James?
I would say ego, yes. But not in a bad way. But and more so because they are not educated or have the knowledge for themselves, or getting advice from people who actually done it before. So I think they just have the idea of, because I need to hit, like, let's say 100 kilo for a bench press, I need to bench 100 kilos during training at the very least. So but then they actually do it in training, but it's like RPE 10 every week. And then maybe they started failing throughout the peaking phase. That may actually reduce their overall performance, because their head is so stuck to that specific numbers. But at the same time, I think it's a good thing, because it really quote unquote cancel their mental barrier of a certain load that they will be lifting. If they can strike a fine balance between them, I think it actually can be beneficial. But more so, they don't want to grind themselves to the dust through the peaking phase.
Mentally, it's big too.
Yeah.
Okay, and building that confidence. Okay, what are some things that you keep in mind? What is the best mental state for someone to go into a meet? I know you already answered this kind of a little bit, being confident and things like that.
Mental state, I think, depending on their personality. Because some of them are very reserved. I have most of my clients are pretty reserved. Like, they don't show much expression or hype during the lift. They find the quote-unquote fire internal, and they just go out there and perform. Right. But I do also have athletes that is really hype. So giving them more self-talk, positive reinforcement, And telling them to like specific words that will trigger a response to get them fired up.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are ways to help change their mental state and that they can perform on competition. So I think it depends on the personality. Mm-hmm. So we have to swing both ways as well.
Right.
But in most cases, I think self-talk, giving them positive reinforcement and not giving them like technique advice during competition is a good way to start.
Right. Like 2 weeks out, being like, oh, you're like 1 week out and be like, wait, you're not like squatting deep enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
Yeah, because I'm usually, I think, really anxious like 1 or 2 weeks out. And I, what are some things that I do? I probably just like do a lot of like mental training. I just imagine what it's like when I'm at the platform and try to vision exactly what it's going to be like. And that kind of helps me calm a little bit. Do you have any advice for lifters before competition? Like if they're really anxious and panicking and like, oh, I don't know if I'll do well. What if I fail my first attempt? What are some things that you tell your clients and some advice for clients?
So I think advice wise, similarly to what you mentioned, visualization of them competing, I think it's a very good start. Just running the motion of them getting under the bar, squatting, bench pressing, deadlifting, replicating the technique that they will be displaying in their head. There's actually some research that shows that it's beneficial for performance.
Mm-hmm.
But anxious-wise, I tend to distract them a little bit with things outside of training. So they don't change their mindset of how they are going to perform. And in most cases, I always use the phrase, trainings will be harder than competition. Because in training, you're doing this, let's say, for most cases, they do up to like 6 singles for a second attempt. And imagine that if you are able to complete that, what's 3 singles to you in a competition? Because you're doing more load previously, and now that you have the rest, you'll be okay to perform even better than what it is in training. So that is what usually helps. And to add on to the self-talk, for people who are anxious, it's really just giving them that confidence back at the start to acknowledge that they are capable, having faith in them. I think give them a really strong mental mindset that they'll be able to perform because they don't trust themselves. But for the coach, being able to give the 100% faith in them, I think helps a lot with their mental aspect leading into competition.
Yeah, especially like
when I'm really anxious, like the only thing that helps me calm down is being in the gym. And when I'm not in the gym, it's I'm circulating a lot of like like subjective, like unrealistic things. Like it's going crazy in my head, and it's really nice to have someone that can objectively look at it. And like you said, you know, you've done 6 singles in training while you're at peak fatigue. Right now, you're not fatigued. Like you're going to do fine. Just 3 attempts, and just hearing that from a coach just does really, really help you. So. And really important, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's really, really interesting. The mental side of the peaking phase.
Yeah.
Okay. What about what about maybe a little bit on the taper? What does your client's training look like 1 week out?
Okay. So for that, usually I go for a reduction in volume for up to 50% in their training volume. So, but for each individual lift, for squat, we reduce the volume by 50%. Bench press, we reduce the volume by 40%. And deadlift, we reduce the volume by 60%. So that's a rough guide I tend to follow if everything goes well. because why bench press is slightly higher in terms of volume is because it's quite intensity sensitive. Like I tried, or rather I experienced with multiple clients that it's quite hard to maintain a bench press strength when the intensity and volume is very low. So we tend to keep it slightly higher and have the how would I call it? The PAP set prior to the meet. I think that helps a lot. Post-potentiation activation is such a hard word to pronounce.
Right.
But yeah. That tends to give them a better experience with bench press altogether. And deadlift, we tend to have a big reduction because in peaking phase, depending on for most of them, they deadlift twice a week. So when we taper, we only deadlift once a week leading into competition. So that reduction really clears up a lot of fatigue for them. Because at the end of the day in the meet, the deadlift still comes last. So we want to be really fresh for that and that they can perform to their best, because deadlift tends to be the closer for a very close meet, depending on how much you can pull. So deadlift has to be, if not one of the strongest lead, if they have a big deadlift to really close out the entire competition.
And 50% of your squat max, if you think about it, is very, very light, right? What is the point of still doing this kind of training on the last week? Like, what? It's light. It seems like it's not doing anything to your body. Like, what is the point of doing this, reducing it and still training 1 week out?
Oh, okay. So the reduction in the squat is 50% is the overall volume. So the intensity still stays, the intensity still stays at 75 to 85% range.
Okay.
So, but the repetition, usually we drop it even further. So let's say, they are doing squat for, 5 repetition at 80% for during the picking. But, during the taper, we'll do something like, 3 sets of pre-repetition at 80%. So because as we train, we may have experienced that at a same percentage, the lower the repetition, the lower the RPE. So by doing 3 repetition instead of 5, we drop the overall exertion level, and that should pay up their fatigue while maintaining their performance going into the meet.
Right. So still keeping the fitness while you drop the fatigue.
Yeah.
Sorry for the miss.
No problem.
Okay. So a lot of calculations go into this, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, well, I think it's, I don't know. We've talked about the whole going into the peaking phase and also like the volume and the intensity and also tapering, the mental aspect side of it. Okay, all coming together for this one day. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What else was there? I don't know. Maybe difference between like a squat, bench press and deadlift, like volume. Do they, does that differ during the peaking period? You gave me a very broad number of it, like dropping, well, having intensity of 85 to 95%, you know, volume reducing it by 20 to 30%. Does it vary between squat, bench, and deadlift?
It don't vary that much for the 3 lifts, but usually for deadlift, it has the biggest quote-unquote drop in the volume as compared to squat and bench press. Bench press usually maintain the highest in terms of the reduction. So we have to do like a lot of bench press to improve or if not maintain the overall strength. And to give a rough sense, the reduction tends to be around if I were to give an exact number, I would say 80% of peak volume of what they have done in earlier phases. Mm. So like, let's say squat is 10,000 kilos per week. They will do like 8,000 during the peaking phase in total volume. Yeah, that way they can really express their strength potential leading into the meet.
Okay. So doesn't vary too much. Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, and what do you think differentiates the strength guides programming to other program like styles of programming? What makes the strength guides more like a unique program?
This one may it's a tough question as well.
Yeah.
So I'm just gonna say based off my opinion and not gonna touch too much on the other companies, so I don't get strength guys, we focus a lot on data and data collection based off their training and technique analysis as well in terms of improving their overall strength because strength itself is multifactorial. So like training volume, training age, your stress level, your coordination, all this will impact your strength over time. So just by delivering good technical analysis advice to them to have them create really consistent technique that they themselves can perform over time, it reduces the appearance of them making training harder than what it seems based on technique variation. And then with the data collection, it gives us really good insights of how much training volume is needed to be done for them to improve their strength or in the worst case scenario is if that volume is too much for them to actually recover, and that's where we can adjust accordingly to pinpoint where is the sweet spot for them, like some of which they may call it the minimal effective volume and then the maximal recovery volume. So that is something that we look out for within our data as well. And the data actually gives us a really good insight for load management and injury reduction. So because sometimes when we know that we do too much or the clients do too much, they tend to get like sore knees or like sore elbows. So that's the data we are looking for at like maybe let's say 50,000 squat volume is creating some sore knee. We may want to scale it back down for a period of time for the knee to actually adapt to the stimulus before we increase the training volume again. Because our muscle tends to improve much quicker and recover faster, but the joints don't actually do that. So that's something we actually pinpoint with the data. And I think with this together with the technique analysis, I think it helps a lot of lifters learn of what they can achieve with their own body, because every one of us is different in terms of personality, limb length, torso length, everything. So finding and troubleshooting one that works best for them over time will give them the best way to improve their overall strength. So yeah, I think that's what makes the item stand out as compared to the other company, just in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think also, Jason did tell me a little bit about the data aspect of the strength guys and what that's why it makes the strength guys really special. But I think a lot of maybe some people maybe like have opinions of being like our bodies don't like work like machines, you know, like they have different lifestyle, they have different fatigue level, they have different maybe have injuries. But obviously, when they do have injuries, like you would deal with it, like you said, like troubleshoot it and, you know, maybe talk about their lifestyle too. Like, but the data relies is the backbone of the program. But also, you also get the maybe sometimes anecdotal things, and try to incorporate that into the coaching platform. Okay. So it's like, so it's like a balance. It's not only just data. It's
correct. About
the balance of it all. It makes it very worthwhile. Okay. No, it was a very, very information packed episode today. Where can people reach you?
So they can reach me over on Instagram, Jonathan at THG. So my message box is always open. So people can just feel free to text me if they have any questions or anything that we have talked about over on this episode.
Awesome. That's great. And also with coaching, if you have, maybe you need to reach out to the Strength Guys for coaching if someone wants to be coached.
Yeah. So if you, they want to be coached, they can reach out to thestrengthguys.com. And that's they can find me as one of their coach for the coaching services.
Awesome. So I think they have a website as well. So I'll be linking their Instagram website to the Strength Guys and also Jonathan's Instagram on the description of this episode. Okay. Thank you so much for being here with me today. A lot of good information. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kenneth, for inviting me. It's my first time, and it was a pleasure joining the podcast.
That's great. Thank you.